You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when is depression just a passing condition, and when does it require long-term treatment? And what alternatives are there when treatments don't work? A doctor specializing in depression treatment joins the show.
First, you may not have realized it, but today is Bill of Rights Day, the anniversary of the ratification of the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution. Officially adopted 225 years ago, the Bill of Rights is a pillar of American democracy. But how well do we really know what it says?
Maybe not as well as we might think. A 2015 survey by the Annenberg Public Policy Center found a surprising amount of confusion as to what's actually guaranteed in the document. For example, the survey found that 1 in 3 Americans believe the Bill of Rights guarantees the right to home ownership, 1 in 4 Americans believe it guarantees equal pay for equal work, and 1 in 10 Americans said it guarantees the right to own a pet.
Julie Silverbrook joins us now. She's the executive director of the Constitutional Sources Project, which looks to increase understanding of and encourage discussion about the U.S. Constitution. Julie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and happy Bill of Rights Day.
Why, thank you. Same to you. So first off, give us a sense as to how important the Bill of Rights really is to democracy here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, the Bill of Rights really articulates our core national values and ideals. It includes things like the guarantee of freedom of speech, the free exercise of religion, and the freedom of the press, the right to assemble, the promise of a speedy trial by jury, the protection against double jeopardy and unreasonable searches and seizures, and the recognition of the right to bear arms. This is really foundational stuff, and just as the statistic you read about 1 in 10 Americans believing that the Bill of Rights includes the right to own a pet, that really underscores how little Americans know about their Bill of Rights and their fundamental freedoms.
So what led to the creation of this particular document, this particular part of the Constitution?
Yeah, so I think some folks might be surprised to know that when the Constitution is signed in September of 1787, the Bill of Rights isn't attached to it. When George Mason of Virginia proposes that a Bill of Rights be added to the Constitution about 5 days prior to the end of the Constitutional Convention, his proposal was near unanimously rejected. The prevailing view was that the state declarations of rights were sufficient and a federal Bill of Rights was unnecessary or possibly even dangerous. So the Constitution gets submitted to the states for ratification, which is going to give the Constitution legal force. Keep in mind, when it's signed in September 1787, it's still just a proposal. So it gets submitted to the states with no Bill of Rights attached. What happens is that the Bill of Rights becomes a rallying call for a group that we call anti-federalists. These are the folks who opposed ratifying the new Constitution. And they're really concerned about limiting the reach of the new federal government. Within that group is a more clamorous enclave of folks who favored amendments that would actually alter the structure and power of the new federal government. For Federalists like James Madison, who we call the father of the Constitution, he's undeniably the father of the Bill of Rights, this is unacceptable. So his decision to draft and push the first Congress to pass the Bill of Rights has to be understood in the context of, I think he calls Bills of Rights parchment barriers. He's not so sure they're necessary, but he really doesn't want these amendments altering the structure of the Constitution. He really doesn't want those to go through, and so he says, let's do the Bill of Rights instead. And he, I think, also came around to see the broader value of the Bill of Rights as well. So he proposes to insert his amendments into the text of the Constitution itself. His attempt to incorporate these amendments into the main body of the Constitution, that's ultimately rejected by Congress. The House, which is where the Bill of Rights originated, instead votes on 17 supplements to the Constitution, sends them over to the Senate. The Senate reduces that number to 12, and then they send those 12 amendments to the states for ratification. And on December 15, 1791, Virginia became the 10th of 14 states to approve 10 of those 12 amendments, and those 10 amendments came to be known as our Bill of Rights.
And so some of the parts of the Bill of Rights that get mentioned quite often are the First Amendment, freedom of speech, taking the Fifth, not having to incriminate yourself. The Second Amendment is a very big topic right now with guns rights and gun control. Have those always been the biggies of the Bill of Rights, or has that changed as our history and our culture has changed?
Yeah, I think that the First Amendment is very important, although it's important to note that the Bill of Rights doesn't get quite as much play in the early part of our history. It's really in the 20th century that the Bill of Rights is invoked a lot, and folks really start to focus on the Bill of Rights. And in fact, when I travel the country talking to citizens about the Constitution, and I ask them, what's your favorite part of the Constitution, they almost always cite a provision of the Bill of Rights, and the top two are the First Amendment and the Second Amendment. You know, I think, as you mentioned, the criminal justice amendments are also really important. I think the Fourth Amendment, sort of post 9/11, really gained a lot of attention. So some of it depends on what the contemporary issues are.
And would you say that it's partly the way that we're taught things like the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, maybe in a civics class when, you know, it's really having to take a test to get out of high school or something like that? Is it partly how it's taught and when we're taught it that explains why there's kind of so little understanding of what this document's really about?
Yeah, so over the course of the last several decades, schools, primary and secondary schools, have been cutting back classroom time devoted to civics and history education. So folks are getting less opportunity when they're young to learn about, you know, which is a pretty rich and complex history that we have here in the United States. They're not learning about it K through 12. A survey released last year by the American Council of Trustees and Alumni found that only about 18% of colleges and universities require a foundational course in American history or government. So we're not doing as good of a job teaching folks in primary and secondary school. Then if they go on to college, they're not really getting it there. And so we're sending citizens into the world with little working knowledge about the way that their form of government works.
And what would you say is the biggest threat of that or risk of that?
Well, I always go back to this famous story that a woman approaches Benjamin Franklin at the end of the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia and asks him what sort of government the delegates had created. And Franklin famously replies, "A republic, if you can keep it." And it's the "if you can keep it" part. This is where education is key. To keep it, we have to teach it, because you cannot defend what you do not understand. So the first line of defense in defending our system of government and defending our individual rights is educating folks about both of those things.
So it feels sometimes that political parties try and claim the Constitution for themselves, that Democrats or Republicans will try and use it to justify a certain policy item or proposal or position that they're taking. And so the Constitution can sometimes feel like it's become a politicized weapon. Can you make that case that it actually should be a unifier as opposed to a divider?
I actually think in what you just said, it shows that it's a unifier. And even when we're making partisan arguments and we're using the Constitution, as you used it, weaponized, the fact is the dialogue is the way that it is because it's premised on the same foundation, the Constitution. So I wrote a piece for the Washington Times back in September about the way that the Constitution is discussed on the was discussed on the campaign trail in 2016. So the different ways that Donald Trump discusses the Constitution versus how Hillary Clinton discussed the Constitution. And so even though it can be used in partisan political arguments, the nature of that discussion is dictated by what unifies us, which is the Constitution.
And one of the big issues that will be coming up as a new president takes office is who will be appointed to or nominated for the U.S. Supreme Court to fill that ninth seat. And how much, it's often said that, you know, certain judges are constitutionalists, and it kind of depends who's describing a justice, whether they see them as a constitutionalist, a strict constitutionalist or not. What does it really mean when they talk about those judges?
Yeah, I think most judges would call themselves constitutionalists. I think the question is, how do you interpret the Constitution? Do you interpret it in according to its original meaning, original 18th century meaning? Do you look at, and even within originalism, it's, you know, original public meaning or original intent? And then there are people who believe that the Constitution is a living, evolving document, and that's really where the fault line is between justices and jurists generally, but I think everybody would say that they're a constitutionalist, although you're not required to be a lawyer to be a Supreme Court justice. All of our current justices are, and when they were sworn into whatever bar they're a member of, they swore an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution.
And as we wrap up, what would you say is a good way to celebrate the Bill of Rights today and going forward?
I think a really easy way to do it is, if you're listening to the radio today, you can go online and pull up the text of the Bill of Rights. It's not that long. And just read it. It's, I think, an emotional read. And then I think, you know, folks really, you know, you're a citizen your entire life. You have a strong incentive to want to be informed and engaged your entire life. Government will be better and will work better for the people if they're engaged. And so I would just say take advantage of the resources that are out there. You can learn more about the history of the Constitution at consource.org. And if you want to learn more about the organizations all over the country that host public programs and develop free resources for citizens of all ages to learn more about the Constitution, you can check out the National Constitutional Literacy Campaign website at constitutiondays.org, where we like to say every day is Constitution Day, except for December 15th. That's Bill of Rights Day.
Well, Julie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Julie Silverbrook, Executive Director of the Constitutional Sources Project. She joined us to talk about Bill of Rights Day and the importance of constitutional literacy in America.